Hi, this is Chuck Axon from Team Roberts. Thanks to all listeners for supporting Team Roberts in MotoGP for 2006, and we look forward to the 2007 season. And you're listening to MotoGP OD.
The lights are on red. We're away.
Greetings, listeners, and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is March 19th, 2007, and this is show 75. My name is Jules Cisek, and I'm sitting in for Bob Hayes and Jim Race. This show consists of the second portion of a conversation between myself, Liam Schubert of Dan Team Primark MotoGP, and Chuck Axland of Team KR, followed by a race report and a post-Qatar race conversation with Liam after the race, and then some condensed news and listener mail. For those of you wondering what happened to the rest of the 2006 season review with Kropotkin, here's the story. Part 2 and Part 3 of the review are quite good, but they are very long, about 90 minutes each. I didn't want to eat up so much time in the podcast, and I didn't want to edit those episodes down. And I also, some listeners didn't find the review very interesting. So what I decided to do was to post the two review segments outside of the MotoGP OD feed, so those who are interested can download them manually and listen to them that way. I don't actually have them up yet, but as soon as they are up, I will let you know here on the main feed. Let's get started. First, we have part two of the Chuck Axon interview Liam and I conducted just prior to the start of the season.
Questions that we didn't touch on?
Just one more question. You guys were, you know, comparing notes kind of like about your two teams. And as far as These are teams that are considered satellite or privateer. Some people call them privateer teams, satellite teams. But what is these days? It seems like just getting a team going in MotoGP is such an incredible, you know, expenditure, and you got to have sponsors, obviously. Do you guys feel like you're closer to? This is actually a great question for both of you guys. But do you feel closer to the factory teams or further away? Both in terms of possibilities of good results and you know, access to the best technology and stuff like that.
Who's going first, Liam?
why don't you go, Chuck?
Well, I mean, our sort of philosophy, we've been, you know, for a number of years, we were Yamaha's number one team. And even at that time, we did a lot of development work with the two-strokes. And there came a point where that wasn't very feasible anymore, and we decided, hey, let's try and make our own bike. And, you know, there are advantages, certainly, and disadvantages, but at the end of the day, you know, we lease a motor from Honda. You know, we don't have to worry about that aspect, but all the chassis development and the freedom that we have, basically we could do whatever we want with the frame or the aerodynamics. So we could create a different look. We can continue to try and improve performance. You know, and that technology that we learned from that belongs to us. You know, if we choose to share it with somebody, that's one thing. But, you know, basically the design expertise, the information that we find out comes back into our building. It doesn't belong to anybody else. And for us, there's some advantages there because, you know, it gives us the experience to pursue other things as well. Like, you know, at some stage we like to get into production road bikes and, you know, production motorcycles. And, you know, already we're doing a little bit of work for some superbike teams and developing parts for them. And, you know, this is different angles. And we're not really controlled by a team or by a factory. You know, we control ourselves, and for us that's very important.
In a way, you are a factory team.
Yeah, in a way, I think we're probably in some ways, and it could be argued, we're probably better than a factory team, because, you know, we come back and we're still a relatively small group, could come back or decide at the racetrack and get the information back to our drawing office, and the Monday or sometimes even during the weekend, you know, our guys are working on stuff for the next race. So we're able to react very quickly. You know, we don't have a lot of red tape. We don't have to, you know, go through a big drawn out process. If we decide to make it and it's feasible and it's within budget and, you know, everybody agrees that this is what we need, then we just do it.
Wow. Yes. Yeah. You guys are definitely fast.
You know, I think from, you know, the whole team point of view, it's everybody's more or less, you know, plays a role in developing the bike. I mean, it, you know, we keep a running list of things that, you know, mechanics bring up to make it, you know, make the bike easier to work on that's incorporated in the next design, and, you know, sit down at the end of the year and go through the list, and, you know, hopefully when that new bike comes out, everything's checked off, and then, you know, the process sort of starts again. So, you know, it's not just, we don't have just mechanics that are replacing parts. We, you know, we have mechanics and a team that's involved in the whole development of the bike. So I think that's, you know, it's a bit, well, it's certainly different than the rest of the paddock. And I think, you know, for our guys, that's it's a little bit more rewarding.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you there. Coming from a satellite team viewpoint that I've got, there's definite differences when I walk into the factory garage and see everything that they've got, and then I go into my garage. And part of that's due to the incredible amount of money that Marlboro spends on that team, and just Ducati's years of experience racing in Superbike, and then, you know, everything that they brought from that into MotoGP. So they definitely know how to run a big team.
Sure.
They've got a little bit more of the money, so that makes a lot of things easier. And as far as time, yeah, working with the satellite team, there is a lot more procedure that has to, you have to go through in order to get your pieces, and we don't have the freedom to change what we want if we feel we could do something better. You know, we've signed an agreement to use the factory bike and do the best we can with what they give us. And as far as 2007, I think if the package is right and they let us, we're going to go out there and we're going to do really, really well. So I've got my fingers crossed on the 07 season, and I just hope everything comes to pass the way I hope it does. And, yeah, I guess we're technically really competitors, Chuck.
Yeah, and I think with the new, you know, new engines and new, you know, electronics and the amount of tire grip and stuff, like I said, I think this season is going to be very close, and the competition is going to be great. So it's going to be fun to watch, and obviously you got some good experience on your side, and, you know, we do too. So I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities for different guys to stand on that box.
Yes, and one last thing that I just was reminded about when you were speaking. How do you feel the tire regulations are going to affect 2007?
That's a good question. I guess we won't really know until we get to the first race and see if, you know, out of the allotment, there's stuff that works, you know.
Yeah.
Because I think, I think you, in some aspect, the tire companies have to play a little bit conservative so they can ensure that there's product there that will, you know, will work and get through a race distance and so forth. But, you know, I know there's a lot of development going on during these tests and a lot of preparation going into it. So, I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
And does the tire regulation benefit teams like Team KR?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I think the biggest element to the new tire regulation was that, you know, the tire companies also are obliged to support, you know, the teams, where before, you know, if say Michelin or Bridgestone only wanted to support two teams, then and Michelin didn't want to, or the other tire company didn't want to support the rest, then you might get you know, not forced to, but have to go a route with Dunlop where you're developing tires. And for us, you know, in previous season 2005, you know, we weren't ready, or 2004, we weren't really in a position to work with Dunlop to develop tires.
Tire variables.
It was just kind of a no win. Where now, you know, if you know, we're happy where we are with Michelin, we have the opportunity to work with them, and that's, you know, part of the regulations would ensure that the teams can you know, work with tire companies that they see, you know, good for them, basically.
Chuck, I have a question. I don't know if you're going to be able to answer, but I heard something in the paddock that if you ride for Michelin on race day, if they say you're going to use this tire as opposed to that tire, that you have to use what they tell you you're going to use. Is that true?
I don't think necessarily, no. You know, certainly they suggest and give their input, but if the rider decides he wants to try something different or doesn't agree, or if he tries that tire in warm up or the last qualifying session or whatever and doesn't like it, they don't force you to run anything that you're unhappy with. But you know, certainly they got ideas of how the weekend progresses and are able to give some
One last question for you, Chuck. Now that we're on the phone. What was the reasoning behind Carlos Checa and Kenny Jr. switching bikes? Was that an HRC prompted idea or just something that your two teams put together?
No, that was something we had discussed back at Valencia, because obviously Kenny was going to be the last guy to have a chance to ride an 800. And, you know, after the race in Valencia on Monday, we did a bike swap where we let Taddy Okada ride our bike and then Junior rode Casey's bike. And, you know, for what we went through in the beginning of last year, you know, without Honda's help, we could have gone off in a completely wrong direction, you know, as one of our ways that we were looking to go. So we asked Honda if it would be possible to run one of their 800, especially because we weren't going to be on track until January. They couldn't make it happen at Valencia, so they agreed to let us do it in the first Sepang test, so we did it. And yeah, I mean, there was some good information to come out of it, and it just kind of keeps us in check that, you know, what we have isn't so far away, you know, from being competitive. So yeah, it's good.
Awesome. Thanks. I guess
that's
it. Yeah. We'll let you get back to it. I'm going to get off of Skype because I got to go run some on-foot errands here in Barcelona.
All right.
I got to take my kid to school. All right,
thanks, Chuck.
Thanks a lot.
No worries. We'll see you guys later.
Ciao.
All right.
Bye.
Again, thanks, Chuck, for talking to us. The best of luck in Jerez, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again. I'm going to do the Qatar race report now, and the rest of the show will contain spoilers. So if for some reason you haven't had a chance to watch the race yet, you may want to stop right here. Okay, last chance. The 2007 MotoGP season opened on March 10th, and man, I cannot remember the last time I was this nervous to see what would happen. Actually, I do remember the last time. It was in 2004 when Rossi first saddled the Yamaha, but that was a very different era. Even before Qatar, we were already dumbfounded by the lap times of the 800cc bikes. It seemed that the only thing the reduced capacity did was bring all the manufacturers to a more level field. Last year, there was some grumbling about the engine reduction, but I think that's all past us now, and we're all enthralled by the technology and innovation in the new series of bikes. The debut of the 800cc's has been nothing short of stunning. To make a long story short, Valentino Rossi beat Casey Stoner's lap record from 2006 by 7/10 of a second at Qatar during the QP. That's pretty unbelievable. Starting between the Yamaha pair of Colin Edwards and Valentino Rossi was Ducati's Casey Stoner. Now, the race itself was as different from the first race of last year as I could imagine. There was no first corner drama this time, and straight from the very start, it was Rossi out front and leading the train. We were back to 2005, it seemed, including the ninth place Nicky Hayden struggling to maintain ground. At least, this is how it looked for the first lap. But then, we came to the start-finish straight for the first time at full speed, and Stoner's Ducati effortlessly pulled past Rossi and continued to accelerate. It took all of Rossi's tremendous skill, determination, and Yamaha's fantastic brakes to allow Rossi to come back within a bike length of Stoner's rear wheel at the end of that straight. Honestly, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it in a battle for first place. Stoner didn't slipstream Rossi. He simply passed him as if he had an extra gear.
And not to be outdone, Pedrosa, who is Stoner's bitter rival from the 250 championship of 2005, also managed to speed past the Yamaha, although Rossi was able to hold him off at the end of the straight. This pattern repeated for many exciting laps, with the forerunners pulling away from the main pack, only to be joined by John Hopkins, who outbraked the king of demon breakers himself, Marco Melandri. And Hopper quickly gave chase to Pedrosa. Let's just go over this really quickly again. A relatively healthy Marco Melandri on the Gresini Honda, known as a demon breaker, a demon on the brakes, as Nick Harris likes to say on MotoGP. And he was passed on the brakes by Hopper, whose throttle slash brake wrist was badly broken and looked like Popeye's forearm afterwards. It's just incredible. We then had our first exits. Loris Caparossi went off on lap 6. Randy DePugne on lap 7. Carlos Checa on lap 8. And with Jeremy McWilliams not starting the race and Andrew Pitt retiring with mechanical problems 7 laps from the end, the field was down to 16. So almost everyone would be scoring points. But who would get the 25? So let's go back to the front. I guess one could say that the race was repetitive, with the same pattern repeating lap after lap. Stoner pulling away from Rossi on the straight, Rossi catching Stoner in the slower, tighter sections. But really, this was not the case. Every corner brought excitement as we watched the young talent take on the 7-time world champion, and not just at his most decent. It really looked like Rossi was at his absolute best as he tried every trick in the book to negate Stoner's straight-line advantage. This is the Valentino Rossi who has most to play for, arguably, in his entire career. And this is the Valentino Rossi who cracked older, more experienced men time and time again over his many years. Casey Stoner did not crack, and to put a final nail in the coffin, pulled out a hidden ace card and pulled away from Rossi in the last two laps, setting his fastest time and the circuit record on the last lap, an amazing 1 minute 56.528 seconds, almost a second faster than the best time last year. Hopper, by the way, did manage to pass Pedrosa and make it stick on lap 11, but eventually Pedrosa got ahead, and I think the pain that Hopper must have been feeling prevented him from trying again. Nevertheless, he did finish fourth and just 0.5 seconds from his first podium. Is there anyone left who doubts we'll see Hopper on the podium this year? A couple of things that came to mind after the race. First off, Stoner was just incredible. Being under pressure from the doctor for 20 laps has to be one of the most difficult things he's done in racing so far. Parc Fermé was in amazement, including Rossi, who took his time congratulating the young Australian. Pedrosa looked lonely in third, but considering one of his strongest tracks, Jerez, is coming up, you have to think he's got a very good shot at staying at the top of the boards. One annoying aside for those who have to watch MotoGP races on the video stream because no one broadcasts the races in real time on TV, Gresini's Hondas look way too much like Fiat Yamahas. In particular, Elias with the yellow numbers looks so much like Rossi that a few times I exclaimed, "Oh no, here we go again," especially when the shot moved to Elias in the desert sand when he went off. Anyway, behind Hopper, Marco Melandri took 5th, Colin Edwards a somewhat disappointing 6th, Chris Vermeulen 7th, Nicky Hayden a somewhat dismal 8th, Dantins Barros a decent 9th, Shinya Nakano 10th, Alex Hoffman 11th, Olivier Jacques 12th, Kenny Roberts Jr. 13th, Tony Elias 14th, and then a massive 9 seconds behind Elias, Sylvain Guintoli on the Dunlop Yamaha Tech 3, with Tamara, the only rider to finish out of the points, a further 6 seconds behind his rookie teammate. Not good, Tamara. And as I mentioned earlier, Andrew Pitt retired with mechanical problems, while Checa, DePugne, and Caparossi went into the sand via front-end tucks. Jeremy McWilliams was unable to ride, which, as it turned out, was more of a tragedy than we had expected. All right. Here's a clip of a phone call to Liam Schubert from last week. We discussed the race in Qatar and wish Dantin Pramac good luck in Jerez. So you're back in Barcelona?
Yes. I am back in Barcelona for almost a week after traveling overnight to and from Qatar. And on Monday, I'll head down to Madrid to the race shop for some last-minute items. And then I'll be driving to Jerez with half of my team.
No
Spanish half.
No Sete Gibernau club this time?
No, I'm not going to be
club.
No, I'm Come rolling on, with a much different crew this time around.
That was the greatest.
that was a killer story. I look forward to seeing them again. In fact, I did run into the girl at one of the races later in the year, either in Brno or Valencia or something. I don't remember.
The president of the club? That chick?
Yes.
Nice. Excellent.
Yeah.
So,
we're live, I guess, so...
You guys did great in Qatar. I didn't even realize... See, the coverage really didn't show Barros or Hoffman until they started making it up into the upper ranks. So I didn't realize they were so far back at one point.
Yeah, it's pretty different what we get to watch and look at as far as live timing and information that's available to the teams as opposed to what's just shown on the telecast or what you can read later on or what you can find online. When you look at live timing on the MotoGP.com website, you just see the start-finish. But when we're watching, we have the option of going to a screen that will show the riders listed, and then it will show them passing through all four sections of the racetrack.
They actually do have that option on MotoGP.com, but I tend to not watch it because they have it basically per track section, but I tend to not watch it because it's about 10 seconds ahead of the feed. So it kind of spoils the, you know, any surprises.
Oh, well, that's too bad.
But I never looked, even when I look, I wouldn't have bothered, I wouldn't have noticed that those guys were that far back down, you know. So they basically made up
that
10 spots.
Yeah, I didn't expect them to have.
That's crazy.
I didn't expect them to have such a rough start. And I regret getting a photo of Alex's leathers when he came into the box. It just wasn't the time or the place. But I don't know, he took a good shot and he came back swinging, so I give him some good respect for that.
Yeah, he definitely knows how to mix it up and stay up.
This is going all wrong. This sounds stupid. Let's start over.
Nice. But really, for the first race, it's pretty damn good results. Both people in the points, not just any points, but like up in the top 10 for Barros.
Yeah,
great stuff.
I'm happy because at the end of the day, this is the highest I've finished in a MotoGP race, finishing within the top 10. We did finish 10th last year, I believe, in Catalunya, but that was after so many people had gone out of the race during the first corner pileup, so I didn't consider that to be a real race condition. And we were looking at coming in really well in Laguna Seca, but then a few corners from the end we had a bobble. So, fortunately, we didn't get it done there. But I think this was a good race for us because it signaled that even from the very back, if we were as far back as you could get, we could still make up ground. And part of that was due to the straightaway there. I mean, we naturally could use that the same way the factory Ducati did.
Right.
But you play to your strengths.
I mean, Barros had the fastest bike of the day.
Yeah, he did. But there again, I think it's a little easier when you're chasing somebody to get up to that kind of speed rather than if you're actively trying to fend off Rossi. Or it's always different when you've got somebody around you and you don't know if they're coming up on the left or the right. I mean, it's not like these guys have rearview mirrors, so enough can't be said how different it is to be in a race scenario when you've got another rider there, especially the doctor. If there's any guy you don't want to have following you, studying your lines for 15 laps, that's the guy.
So the whole team was satisfied with results, given that the race, the start was a tough one?
I think it was a mixed emotion. I mean, there was a lot of happiness that both bikes finished the race, and a lot of happiness that we proved that we could do it. You know, the team was working well and the riders knew what they were doing. I look at it more as a building block and a stepping stone for better results because, you know, imagine what we could have done if we hadn't have been down there at the end of the first lap. You know, I anticipated fighting up near the top five, four through sixth, or even better, depending on what kind of toe we could get. You know, and I look forward to seeing that happen in a future race. It was kind of gut-wrenching. It was gut-wrenching, I think, because I watched the start basically from pit wall, and then I ran back in the box to check out the monitors. And to see our riders down there at the bottom just kind of the first thought I had was, oh my God, Barros is having a World Superbike start. And I couldn't figure out what happened to Hoffman. You know, we didn't know what exactly happened until the end of the race. There's a split second, if you watch the video, where you'll see him completely offline, you know, out of the pack, coming out of the first corner. But I missed seeing that during the race, so it wasn't until I watched later that I even picked up on it. I don't know. It's a building block, and I just hope that we can continue to improve and do our best.
What is your take on Jerez? I mean, last year Caprossi did some wonders on the Ducati there with the Bridgestones, but Gibernau was not so great.
Well,
she seems suited for that track.
You know, when I look at data from previous races, especially last year, I think it has more to do with confidence of the rider in their package than the actual reality, because the 800s are a different animal.
Yeah.
So it's not really a direct comparison to say that, oh, you know, so-and-so destroyed the field here last year, so naturally they're going to do it again. The tires are a different generation. The bike is a completely different generation. I think the most value you're going to see in results is a rider saying, yeah, I kicked everyone's ass here last year, and I know I can do it again.
Good point. I do think, though, that there's a certain philosophy to each manufacturer. I think the Ducati's always been about, you know, power and having good power under the riders, you know. So they seem to have it again.
I don't know if it's power. This is going to be interesting. I think you need big power to push a big fairing at high speed, because the amount of horsepower required to accelerate once you're around 200 miles an hour, it just increases exponentially for the surface area you have. So horsepower has always been important in the Ducati philosophy for their GP bike. If you look at their superbike effort, the philosophy has always been tractability, which is something that the twins provide naturally, and then also with the electronics, it's only enhanced. So in the GP realm, I think they went for big power because that's what they're capable of. I'm sure they could detune it. Sure, they could make it more powerful. Right now, it looks good because, you know, on that straight, it proved that it had value. In that race, it had value. Maybe I'm sure at other racetracks, everything's going to be different.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're going to be able to answer this, but if you're allowed to answer this, but the way I was, so when I was looking at that the run on the straight, and they were showing, you know, obviously Stoner and Rossi every lap, so every lap was the same thing. It was like what it looked like to me was that it was more than just power, maybe it was like better aerodynamics or something on that bike, because it just like the acceleration didn't change. He just kept accelerating at the same rate.
Well, I think
I think
we had the seventh gear in there.
That's really what it looked like.
Definitely aerodynamics comes into play.
At that speed, it must be a huge
Definitely
huge
aerodynamics
factor.
Comes into play. But I think that was, it wasn't just aerodynamics, because if you look at the slow section where they're just coming out of that final corner, that's a second gear corner, if I remember correctly. Even just coming out of the corner before aerodynamics is very important. The bike was just motoring. I mean, it was powering away. There was no need to slingshot in a draft. You know, Stoner could come out on a different line and just full gas.
He did a couple of times. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think in a way that shocked Rossi. I don't know. I know I'd be frustrated as heck if I was doing everything I could in the infield, and, you know, and kind of powerless to stop the straightaway.
Yeah.
So
I think there's a lot of detractors that are saying that, you know, that the bike won the race, but I think it's bullshit because Stoner really rode super well, and there's such intense pressure from Rossi the whole time, and he kept an ace in his pocket because he opened it up in the last two laps to like really, you know, dig in, make sure he was going to be ahead.
That's a testament, I think, to the Bridgestones also, that he had his fastest lap of the weekend on race tires in that final lap of the race. So, I mean, this is a tire that's undergone 22 laps, pulling off Rossi, and then he goes out and sets his fastest time on that set of tires. I thought that was pretty significant.
The only person I've actually seen that do that also was Rossi last year. There was a couple of races he had where he actually in 2005 also where he just
he's done that every year.
Even on 500. What, fastest lap of the last one, really?
Yeah, why not? I couldn't quote you something specific, but it's a doctor, and anything's possible with him.
Yeah, it's true.
I wouldn't be surprised if he did that more often than most.
I don't have much time left, unfortunately, but I wanted to just get your thoughts on Jerez and
thoughts on Jerez. Let's see if I can make this concise. I'm nervous and excited once again because this is a track where we had some difficulties at the IRTA test a few weeks ago, and I'm sure weather conditions played into that a tiny bit, but overall, you know, I hope that the factory has done their homework and has been, you know, the engineers back at the shop that don't go to the racetrack, I hope those guys have been working on things because my riders are itching to go. And I think the tires will work okay there. I won't know until, I won't have a feeling until Friday and Saturday, and then I'll go, That's when I'll change the music from the high energy stuff, and I'll put some Chopin on, a nice nocturne, Saturday night. Yeah. Something nice for the race. I don't know. I'm excited. I mean, the overall emotion is just, there's so much adrenaline that comes into my life when I think about what's going on and what's happening and what I'm involved with, that if I turn that off even for a minute, then it's full system stop. You know, I'll sleep for 15 hours. everything cuts. You know, it's either full gas or nothing, it seems at this point. And, Jerez, let's bring on Jerez.
Right on. Good luck, man. Yeah. Did you catch the Daytona race by any chance?
What's that?
The Daytona 200? You know, that race they do it.
That was a joke. No, I read quite a bit about it on the computer.
Yeah.
I didn't get it. I don't have time to really watch anything. I watched the Qatar race one more time. I got to go see Hiro tomorrow, Aoyama, because he's recovering from surgery to his hand from the crash he had.
Oh, shit. I didn't know he was that hurt.
Race.
Wow.
Yeah, he lost a good chunk of a finger, and they were scheduled to perform a skin graft, but during the operation they determined that they weren't going to have to go to that extreme. So
he
got home yesterday, and I'll probably
drop off. I just saw him walking away from the bike. It looked like he wasn't in that much pain. He just looked like he was kind of upset about it. But wow, that sucks.
Well, yeah, I mean these are things that happen. McWilliams. Lost a chunk of finger that he doesn't need.
Yeah.
I guess Hero's in the same club. Anyway.
All right, so very cool. Thanks very much. And I'll try to catch up with you in Jerez.
Great. Thanks, everybody, for listening to MotoGPOD. And sorry, I sound so sick. Still trying to recover from Qatar.
You know, in Polish, Qatar means... sneeze, or runny nose, actually. Yeah,
that's exactly what I had.
Thanks, Liam. I just wanted to know, I really like what Liam said about rider confidence. If you think about it, at this level of sport and technology, it follows that what gives you the edge is supreme confidence. This is clearly demonstrated by Stoner's win. After all, he has a tremendous record in Qatar, both from last year where he set pole and led the race before fading a bit. And don't forget, he won the 2005 race there while in the 250s. Which brings me to Jerez. In a few days, we're going to see the bikes back on European soil in front of 100,000 fans
and most of the cards now are on the table. Will Rossi get his first win since Sepang 2006? Will Ducati give Stoner and Caparossi enough edge to repeat Caparex's dominating win from 2006? Will it be Pedrosa, who last year shocked everyone, fighting for first place in his very first race in the MotoGP class? Or will we see an unfamiliar face on the podium, say a young John Hopper, or the often surprising Tony Elias end up on the top of the podium? All I know is I'm very psyched to see this race. Episode 74 generated a lot of feedback, and I thank you for that, and most of it concerned my decision not to recap news. Well, you guys have changed my mind, so here's a quick recap of news since that episode. Sponsors started to fall into place after the final test, but the situation is still pretty dismal considering the surging popularity of MotoGP. Yamaha finally revealed long-suspected Fiat as their prime sponsor. Team KR got a commitment from Motorpoint, and Gresini got Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Hansbury. What we didn't hear was whether or not Ilmor, the series rookie manufacturer, whether they would land a sponsor. Unfortunately, the worst fears proved true. As soon after the team returned from Qatar, they announced immediate withdrawal from the championship. It's a real shame, as although the bikes were having trouble keeping up, they were still getting plenty of airtime, and it's just mind-boggling why some sponsor didn't show up with a suitcase full of cash. And sadly, that 42-year-old Jerry McWilliams didn't even get to ride a race, and he has little to show for it except a missing finger. And now turning to listener mail, Greg Sampson writes, I know I'm a bit behind the times, but only just had a chance to see the article pertaining to MotoGP race being staged at the Indy F1 circuit. I honestly cannot think of a worse location for staging a race. I know Indy is steeped in tradition, but the thought of having GP bikes skirting the oval track in either direction, left in Indy T1 or right in Indy T1, makes me sick. I'm a huge fan of the Irish open roads races, but that's a far cry from what the riders will be facing in the event of mechanical difficulty at the track. Doesn't anyone remember Daijiro Kato's accident at Suzuka? Daytona switched from liter bikes to 600cc for the Daytona 200 because they felt the bikes were just too fast for the course, and I tend to agree. It just seems terribly archaic to hold a race in a venue of this nature. Having another USGP would be excellent, but why can't they pick a track more suited to bikes? Heck, even Watkins Glen would be a better place to stage a GP than Indy. Imagine seeing Hayden and Rossi slip slide down into the boot. What about Road America, Miller Motorsports in Utah, or Barber at Alabama? I know Barber is short and tight for a GP bike, but it's still a heck of a lot safer than Indy and no worse for racing than Laguna Seca. Well said, Greg, and I mostly agree with you. After seeing some plans for the proposed changes at Indianapolis Raceway, I still don't see how the bikes will avoid riding closely to the wall at one of the fastest points on the track. Nevertheless, I'm reserving my full opinion until I see the results, and frankly, Indianapolis is world famous, and if this is the only other USGP that we can currently have, then I'm all for it. If the fans show their support for two USGPs, I'm certain it will be an amazing thing for our little subculture. And yeah, Miller Motorsports is one amazing-looking track. It's just that it's in the middle of nowhere, really. I think first we have to deal with the famous location, Indianapolis. My big question is, when will the 125s and 250s finally visit the U.S.? Will we forever see just a third of the GP circus here in America? By the way, I'm also putting in a vote for Sears Point, Infineon Raceway. It's 40 minutes from my door. Yes, I realize it will never happen, but a man can dream, right? Joe Apple writes, any thoughts on the new high-resolution premium package that MotoGP.com is offering for the 07 season? At approximately $130 US, this is quite a chunk of money to spend on faith that it's going to actually work. Now, Joe wrote this email to me prior to the Qatar race, and I don't know if he bought the expensive package or not, but I can tell you I did, and after a bunch of scary hiccups during the qualifying, when myself and various other fans all over the world lost the stream, MotoGP admitted that there was a problem and, more importantly, fixed it. So on race day, the high-res feed was fantastic, and I do recommend it if you have the means. In addition to Joe and Greg, I'd also like to thank listeners K
Kev Daniels, DRC Racing, from the Right on 2 forum, Neil Leach, John Anderson, Warren Kurtz, Alan Clarkson Dodds, and especially Scott Jones for his generous donation. Thank you all for your emails. Keep them coming, guys. Got some cool stuff ready for the next show, but I'm not really sure when it will go up. I'm off to the Far East tomorrow, and I don't know how much time I'll have at the computer or mic for the next 2 weeks. But I will watch the race at Jerez, of course, and would like to invite all of you who watch the race live, either via TV or MotoGP.com video stream, to join me and several other fans on the Ride On 2 IRC channel. It's like a chat channel, old school. I've included a link to containing information on the channel in the show notes. Finally, myself and some others have created a Google Calendar with race times and information such as Google Maps, some stats about the tracks. If you use Google Calendar, just follow the directions at the link given in the show notes and check it out. Many big thanks to Chuck Axland and, of course, Liam Schubert, to all the listeners and to all MotoGP fans. Be good, be safe. I'll talk to you soon. Ciao.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them.